Gresham College presents Creating New Species, The Future of Man and His Dominion Over Other Animals by Keith Kendrick, Gresham Professor of Physics.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Gresham College. If I can make this work. For the last two lectures of this series, I'm going to be an awful lot more speculative than I am wont to be, hence a really ambitious title for this one, Creating New Species, but it's not quite as ambitious as perhaps you might think. Obviously, to some people, the idea that we can create new species at all is against perhaps even our sort of moral principles. But if you look at what is likely to be achieved by modern biology, at least, during the next century, and I'm trying to look that far in advance, not just what's going to happen next year, it's likely that at least one of the major discoveries in biology, which will have all sorts of implications, will be that we can create life from just the simple building blocks, whether they be the ones we already know about or whether they be completely new artificial ones. There are a number of other things that we discovered as well, and in my next lecture I'll start talking about what's going to happen in terms of perhaps our understanding of how the brain works and what we can do in terms of exploiting that. So really these two lectures are really just trying to make you think about what is now science fiction, but perhaps within the next part of this century will become science fact and what we will do with it. So will we really be able to design and create new life forms? It seems quite outrageous. But I'm not going to leap straight into that. You'll get it in the end. It's pretty heavy sort of chemistry and genetics, and I don't intend to bore you with all of the details, just whether it can actually be done or not. But let's just look, really, take a step back and look at what plant and animal life there is on the planet, what's happening to it, what the human impact is having on it, what we as humans really want other animals and plants for. It may be a bit of a shock, I think, to many people that in terms of the number of living species that we've identified, it's currently about 1.55 million. This is a fraction, in fact, of the number of living species that there are on the planet, perhaps only a sort of 15 or 20% or so. There are a number of ways that people have tried to estimate just how great biodiversity is on our planet, and some of them are quite weird and wonderful, some of them very simple, but they all involve a massive scaling up procedure somewhere along the line. So, but they all come up pretty much with the same figure, around 10 to 50 million different living species, that's both plants and animals, which compares to the 1.55 that since Linnaeus 230 years ago, we've actually managed to identify. This is a kind of interesting one, I'm just going to stop me doing this again, which was produced by May, which is very simple. It works on a simple algorithm that there must be an awful lot smaller species than there are large species, and perhaps there's some kind of linear or other relationship. And when you do that, you plot the large mammals and all the way down to the sort of microbes almost. You, funnily enough, you do come out with an estimate that overall there are between 10 and 50 million species. And that's the same estimate that other people do by just trying to find out how many species there are in a particular ecological niche, in, for example, the middle of the rainforest. So at least 300,000 plant species, perhaps around, but there are still 90% probably still to be identified. As far as animal numbers are concerned, because the ones we know most about are really the minor players in biodiversity. Mammals at 5,416, birds 9,917, amphibians and reptiles nearly 14,000, fish nearly 29,000, crustaceans up to 40,000, and mollusks around 70,000. But the big guys are the insects, nearly a million, and there's probably at least another 10 million of them to be discovered. Now, we've all heard about extinction, and we all know we should be worried about it, but of course it is a natural process. Species, they come, they go, as environments change, it is a natural process. And depending upon who you read, you'll be told that something between 98 and 99% of life forms that have ever existed on the planet have become extinct. What is currently here is only maybe 1 or 2% of the species that have ever lived. And again, depending upon who you read, the average survival time for a particular species is around 10 million years. So we've still got a little while left for Homo sapiens, perhaps. Although if you listen to some quite notable scientists, they don't reckon that we're actually going to survive beyond the end of the current century anyway. So what is this natural extinction rate if we weren't doing anything to impact on the planet? And of course, lots of things can do. It's around 0.01 to 0.001% of species each century. And based on the lowest estimate of the numbers that we have of species of 10 million, that equates to about 100 to 1,000 species each century. So we would expect, if it was just natural extinction, that in the current century might lose up to 1,000 species. In theory, of course, and we have to assume this because no one really knows who's actually identified a new species that's evolved recently, apart from ourselves. The idea, though, is that there's natural compensation. So what leaves is replaced by a new species that has evolved. And, of course, mass extinctions, where large amounts of our dinosaurs actually, well, you never know, it might have been smoking, but it certainly has a pretty big effect on us, that they're nothing new. In fact, there have been a lot of them, and the current one is regarded as being the sixth mass extinction in the planet's history, and it's pretty much entirely down to us. And as you can see from the cartoon, in a sense, we often fail to realize exactly what our activities really do contribute to the extinction of a number of species. In fact, the current extinction rate that's been estimated is it's running at 1% overall each century. And if you then multiply that up, giving the 10 to 50 million species that we should have on the planet, that's a staggering 100,000 to 500,000 species we would expect to be extinct by the end of the current century. As far as the IUCN Red List, the sort of main source of what we consider to be species that are currently under threat, you can see that this also, in fact, comes out to an average of about 1%, but of course it's not even. Mammals are running at about 20% of species that are considered to be seriously under threat. Non-human primates is somewhere near to 30%. So overall, this extinction rate is approximately 100 to 1,000 times above the natural level. And even though various agreements, both a global agreement and an EU agreement, have been made to try to either limit or, in fact, stop the decline in biodiversity by 2010, I find it rather difficult to see how they could do it, or for that matter, because we don't know the majority of species that exist, how they could even monitor the impact they're having anyway. So overall, I think there's very little choice but to conclude that the planet's biodiversity is decreasing and it will continue to do so. Why? Well, it's pretty obvious, really, to start with. The world's population of humans now exceeds 6 billion. And it's increased a staggering sixfold just in the last 150 years. So from 1 billion, sorry, in 1850 to 6 billion in the year 2000. And okay, a lot of people estimate that maybe by 2050 we could actually have less than 6 billion on the planet. There is at least some rate of decline there, but there are others who consider that it will continue to go up and maybe by 2050 it will be 11 billion. But the key thing is that it's still increasing in the areas of major biodiversity on the planet, which are a very small number of regions of the world. And getting back to the whole issue of living forms, of course, the reason that the human population is so big is very simple. It's that we have evolved the use of agriculture. We have harnessed the use of other living organisms to allow our population to expand so much. In fact, it's estimated to be about 30-fold larger as a result of our utilization of agriculture than it would have been naturally. Of course, in terms of our impact on making species extinct, hunting is often blamed for very many of these, and indeed many of the large mammals and birds, that's certainly true. But in fact, the main thing that we do that is limiting biodiversity is to do with the fact that we're eating up all of the natural habitat for our own requirements. And it's that habitat loss and degradation that is really at the root of the reductions in biodiversity. And remember, of course, that it's not evenly distributed all over the planet. In fact, 50% of all animal and plant species live in the closed tropical rainforests, which, of course, we're gradually destroying bit by bit. Of course, you know, we're intelligent. We've got all sorts of tools, and forgetting about whether or not you believe in Jurassic Park and the whole idea, but certainly we are in a position of being able to preserve the DNA of any species and hold it forever. I mean, we can act as, if you like, the world's historical librarians of all life forms, and indeed there are individuals who are doing that. They're collecting all the genes in order that we can sort of hold them in a bank. We might need them one day. We might need to use them to help us adapt in some way. But of course, you can do this, no problem. Whether or not we can bring a species back just from DNA is a question, but in theory, in the end, we probably will be able to be. But what would be the point? You've just destroyed their habitat. They can't survive. So all it would be something that you kept perhaps in a zoo or some kind of collection. So there's no real point in bringing back something that can no longer live on the planet. And sometimes our psychology is very similar to the cartoon. So overall, if we're talking about new species on the planet, it's pretty simple that they're going to have to be species that are A, likely to be useful to us, and B, of course, able to live in some kind of humanized habitat. So what will we need them for? Well, overall, of course, I'm not going to talk about this because it almost goes without saying, we need biodiversity as much as anything else to maintain the whole ecosystem of the planet. It's not a trivial thing, so even though we might be unbothered by the fact that there are 10 million insects, they all play a very important role in maintaining the planet. From our point of view, a very direct usage, of course, is they provide us with food. Something that's very much in the decline, although naturally there are still some examples of this. They can act as labor-saving assistants, but it's unlikely that that's going to be a major role for them in the future. Of course, they also help extend human biomedical advances used in research. But increasingly, and perhaps people maybe not realize the extent of the closeness of humans and other species in the two final areas where they are very much important to us. The first is providing pleasure and companionship. And leading on from that, they also provide very important impact on our psychological and emotional well-being. But, of course, the bottom line is, yes, there might well be up to 50 million species on the planet, but if you count them, how many we actually need directly for food, for biomedical research, for companionship, it's probably less than 50. In fact, it's probably less than 20 if you think about it. And yes, we need agriculture to maintain our current population and future population, and we have been very effective in using old strategies of selective breeding to provide both plant and animal species that really are maximized for their productivity as far as food is concerned. But of course, we're also extremely well aware of what that means in that there have been huge pressures, for example, with farm animals for high productivity and low space utilization because we can't afford to use huge amounts of space. And the same is true of plants, of course, with very high yield plants requiring pesticides, fertilizers, all sorts of treatments. Unfortunately, again, the bottom line is that even if we were to say we won't do any of these things, or we could certainly limit them without causing perhaps a huge impact on our food supply, but to go all of the way to adopt a very low-intensity organic approach for agriculture, we just don't have enough space, or at least certainly a large number of communities on the planet don't have enough landmass to do this. As far as human biomedical advances are concerned, it's worthwhile pointing out, of course, that at least 90% of biomedical research doesn't use animals at all. But the 10% that does is absolutely essential. There is no major drug that has been developed that has not relied in some way on animal experimentation. And, of course, all drugs are continued to be tested for legislative purposes on animals as well. And, yes, we are improving culture-based and in silico or computer-based, if you like, systems, but they still are incapable of totally modeling a living organism. Although we will make advances over the next century in doing that. It's, animal research is here to stay for some time. But of course, we are very worried about the ethical issues of sentient beings, and yes, if you were thinking about perhaps creating new species, you might consider that there would be a possibility of creating something that was useful in a biomedical context, but had less of the ethical issues that current experimental animals do. I'm not saying we should do that, but it's a possibility. What about pleasure and companionship? Well, it's actually quite strange what humans do as far as other species are concerned, although I think most of us never stop to even think about it. We're really the only species that routinely, and I say routinely because some do it sort of from time to time, involve other species in our social groups. Okay, and that's quite a strange thing to do. Why do we do it? Well, to start with, the currents of most of the current companion animals we have, it's probably emerged from a kind of mutual exploitation. It's not just us going out there and sort of, it's a dog, that's a good idea. The dogs almost found us first. They realized that human settlements were actually a good place for food, and that if they did things for us, then we did things for them, and so it went on like that. And it's the same is true for cats. And indeed, if you look, as far as we can understand, about how far human relationships with companion animals date back, for dogs, it's around 10,000 years, a little bit less for cats, 4,000 to 5,000 years. In both cases, of course, dogs and cats were very useful to us in terms of controlling vermin and also for dogs, for example, for warning systems, protection, and so forth. So what are their key characteristics? Well, I'm sure there are lots that you can mention. And just to start with, the first thing, of course, is they can actually be incorporated into our social groups. Not only can we let them do that, but they can let us do that too. It's a mutual thing. They have, by and large, a highly affectionate nature. They tend to be very playful, so that we find them fun. And they have a degree, at least, of individuality and intelligence. And we know that in the UK, there are currently 7 million dogs. There are 8 million cats. And there are 30 million others. And if you look at the dogs and cats, the annual increase, overall annual increase in the numbers, is about 12%. It's a growth area. So yes, at the moment, in fact, you put those all together, there are 45 million pets in our UK population of 60 million. And by the end of the century, I would imagine if it carries on this way, they will considerably outnumber us almost. And it's a big industry, of course, as well. In the US, it's even bigger than it is, in fact, in the UK. At least 50% of households in the US have companion animals like dogs and cats, not just all the other ones, just dogs and cats. And the value of the pet food market in the US alone is $9.2 billion a year. Just looking at the veterinary health industry, just in the UK now, it's $200 million. Of medicines for pets, and believe it or not, that's 56% of the whole market. We actually spend more on veterinary health on our companion animals than we do on agricultural ones. Of course, having these companion animals is not without an impact on the biodiversity of the country. It's a sad but true fact, unfortunately, that in the UK, cats actually kill around 10 million birds each year. which is a very powerful reason for putting bells on their collars. Of course, it's not just the companion animals. Most of us are fascinated by animals. We spend lots of time looking at wildlife programs. We'll go along to zoos, even though perhaps many feel they're a rather sad way of keeping animals. Safari parks, perhaps a bit better. But in general, we really are fascinated by particularly the large mammals and birds. And almost ridiculously as it is, we find films of humanized animals extraordinarily entertaining. Walt Disney Corporation, of course, has made a fortune out of doing this, which makes those of us who do work on animals and try to find out exactly what they can do, since there's so much anthropomorphism out there, seems to be gloriously mundane. Here we have one of my sheep that is capable of discriminating between 50 different human faces, or 50 different sheep faces, sorry, and 10 different human faces at the same time, and can remember them for several years. This is pretty difficult to show, but of course, if we give them a kind of humanized attitude, it seems very mundane, although in fact it isn't. As far as the sort of psychological or even physical and emotional well-being of humans, pets provide us with a huge emotional and psychological support, and for that matter, even education. And it's been concluded in general, overall, that this sort of human-animal bond, as it's referred to, can enhance, for example, the quality of family life. It can, for example, minimize tension between family members. And it can also, of course, overall, simply enhance compassion for living things on the planet. All these are very good things. And increasingly, science has turned to trying to understand what it is about the interaction between us and companion, and for that matter, other species, that is so good for us. And most of those serious attempts have been made from the last 25 years, but of course, if you look back all the way back to the Roman times, you can get examples of horse therapy, for example, for humans, and even when the Quakers, I believe, back in 1650 in this country, used to expose people who were mentally disturbed to farm animals, for example, as one way of trying to make them feel better. But it really kicked off big time, I think, as far as the idea of an animal-assisted type therapy 25 years ago, and it started with this paper by Friedman, where he found that there was for people who actually own pets, dogs and cats, this is now, particularly dogs, I believe, they were 50% more likely to survive 1 year after a major heart attack than people who didn't have pets. And subsequent studies have shown that there are significant reductions not only in survival rates after you've had a heart attack, but also there are reduced risks of actually having one in the first place as well. Why? Well, because it seems that having pets around does all the right things you would expect. It lowers blood pressure, it lowers cholesterol levels, it lowers triglyceride levels, these kinds of things. And these are all fairly well documented. Looking at other aspects of health, just the sort of minor lurgies of life. Other studies have shown that minor health problems seem to be reduced after people acquire pets, so it's not that they had them in the first place. These are advantages after individuals have then sort of taken a pet into their household. And similarly, dog ownership, for example, has been reported to reduce by around 16% the number of elderly individuals who seek direct medical attention. The disappearing man there is for a reason. Very good reason, very unfortunate reason perhaps, but this study, believe it or not, showed that women who are put under deliberate experimental stress, it's not physical stress, it's sort of mental stress as much as anything else, actually showed less stress in the presence of their pet than they did in the presence of their best friend or indeed their husband. Take from that what you will. Similarly, therapy dogs, as they're called, that are trained to be taken into institutions, have been shown to reduce significantly anxiety in institutionalized psychiatric patients. And for some aspects of treatment, which clearly aren't very pleasant, like electroconvulsive shock, which thankfully isn't used quite as much as it used to be, it also reduced anxiety in individuals who knew they were about to be given this treatment. get it in a moment. Whoa, sorry. That's why I didn't get it. Okay, fine. Takes a while. Visits to the dentist. Actually, also far less stressful. I'm sorry, we missed the punchline here, but if you actually have in the surgery tanks of tropical fish, well documented, there you go. Yeah. Makes you feel a bit more relaxed. Interactions with therapy dogs have been shown to reduce depression and also to enhance mood. And there is a sort of biological basis for this. At least some of the studies do try and find a sort of physiological cause for the psychological improvements and emotional improvements. In this case, they've shown that peripherally, at least, there are enhanced or increased levels of some precursors of both serotonin and dopamine, which are very important bioactive transmitters that improve your mood. So overall, you might conclude that we should all be thinking about trying a pet rather than Prozac, even though trying a pet just for that reason would seem to be wrong. But of course, we also know how close we get to pets, and bereavement from them, because they are by and large quite short-lived, has completely the opposite effect in increasing, of course, stress, anxiety, and depression. So in a sense, if we were designing another companion animal, we want them to live longer, I'm pretty sure. And we're so close to animals that we even consider using the new technology of cloning, which is available for cats at least, and indeed increasingly for other domestic species. But of course, no one really has managed to get across to people that where you're cloning using adult cells, where genes are turned off in adulthood that were active when during early development. And so what you will get in terms of your cloned animal is not going to be necessarily that similar to the original model at all. It may not even look quite the same, and certainly behaviorally it could be very different, because behaviorally is not, you know, not only is it going to be dependent upon the genes that were being expressed in the adult cells that have been cloned from, but also, of course, from the experience that they have from the environment. So overall, cloning isn't necessarily going to give you the identical companion animal that you think you're going to get. It doesn't stop people paying £7,000 a go to get one. Moving on again, in terms of recovering from trauma, pets have been shown to have significant supportive role for individuals, for example, with childhood sexual abuse. And the bonds with pets experienced by such individuals by the time they reach adulthood is likely to result in a reduced likelihood of them showing abusive behavior and high levels of anger. With affective disorders, unfortunately, there's less work done and it's not very well controlled, but you would expect this to be an area of quite extreme benefit for interactions between humans with problems with social communication and emotional interpretation with simple companion animals. And indeed, there have been studies showing that both social and communication skills are improved in autistic and schizophrenic individuals. And if you can read that down there, which is written by someone who's suffering from Asperger's, I love dog. I love to have an animal like a dog. I have Asperger's. But of course, as I say, there haven't really been any large-scale studies. And that's one of the problems with this kind of area, trying to really show what advantages animal-assisted therapy can have. Even simple things that you might have thought totally counterintuitive, and this is fairly recent work, has shown that children who grow up in households with pet dogs and cats are much less likely to develop common allergies, and that includes asthma, skin allergies, and so forth. The reason is thought, although by no means proven, to be endotoxins that are formed by the breakdown of bacteria from the animal's saliva in some way improving our pattern of immune response to allergens. Perhaps an area you might not think that pets, no matter what you think about them as far as anthropomorphism, they're not as intelligent as we are. So you might not really imagine that they're going to improve learning, but they do. But they do it in a very simple way, in that whether you're talking about anybody in a sort of classroom full of kids, or you're talking about people who are mentally retarded, or perhaps suffering from neurodegenerative disorders, that being rewarded for new learning by simply petting or stroking a pet or feeding them or just having contact with them at all is a very powerful incentive for learning, and it's used to quite good effect. As I say, even in patients who have Alzheimer's disease. Obvious things, walking a dog, of course, can help with, I haven't mentioned it, but things like control of your weight, but it also helps with improving your motor skills in general. And perhaps the best example of this is horse riding, or hippotherapy, as it's become called, nothing to do with hippopotamus, I hasten to say, which also improves the balance of riding, improves movement, coordination, and so forth. It also has very important psychological advantages. It increases feelings of self-worth and power for individuals who are very often confined most of their lives to wheelchairs. And horses have also now been used increasingly in psychotherapy to improve things like self-concept, self-confidence, and even social competence. We all know, of course, about one of the major uses of companion animals, which is giving us another set of senses, for example, people who are blind, and, of course, very, very close bonds form between people who acquire blind dogs for helping them negotiate the world, and that, therefore, can also give them profound psychological and emotional support as well. Even in prisons, it's not, I don't think, ever been tried in the UK, but I may be wrong. The only evidence I could find is in the US, and not actually Burt Lancaster in the Bourbon of Alcatraz, but nevertheless, it does give you an example of pets. But yeah, there are some formal studies that have shown they have far fewer disciplinary problems with inmates in US prisons when they have access to companion animals. Pets, of course, what they're really, really doing, well, we all know they're a fantastic source of pleasure. Many are demonstrably affectionate and playful. They rarely, it would seem, unlike us, hold grudges and become moody. And they are a very powerful distraction from things that are stressing us, and that's why they help particularly in reducing stress and anxiety. They tend to bring us out of ourselves, so they're very socially empowering. They provide us, of course, with a source of social, emotional, and also tactile interactions as well. Importantly, of course, they really need us, and we know that. They need us to be there. Also, importantly, they do not tend to answer back except with a bark or a meow or occasional things when we use them as sounding boards. And in fact, we don't want them to be substitutes for other humans, no matter what the entertainment industry may be trying to convince us. We've got other humans, after all. We don't want them to be as complex as us, no matter what people might actually say. And why? Well, because it's their simplicity that attracts us to them in the first place. They have very simple qualities, and they totally disregard, for example, the presence of physical or mental disabilities in humans. And as life gets tougher, I don't know whether you give massage yet, but it's pretty clear that we seem to be needing pets for emotional and psychological support more than we've ever done, and this is likely to continue. Perhaps the moving away from companion animals to one of the species, although it's dolphins are not the only cetacean that are species that are interesting to us, but dolphins seem to occupy a very special place in terms of the potential impact that they can have on humans, and many things have been claimed over the centuries. They have been claimed to have very profound therapeutic effects, particularly on children, but also with adults and with mental, emotional, or social disorders. But of course, no one, certainly not me, is saying that we should be breeding large numbers of them in captivity for the purpose of doing this. It's interesting, though, is there really any scientific evidence for what they do? What do they do? And perhaps, if we can find out what it is that they are doing that's beneficial to us, perhaps we can create it in some way artificially. What we do know is it's not just about them appearing to us to be attractive, or for that matter, it's not just about swimming. You don't get the effects that the dolphins show, for example, just swimming around in water. And it's not that actually most of the people who are exposed to them think, oh, they're great, I want to do this, it's a fantastic experience. In fact, very often, especially people who are handicapped, find the whole experience quite fearful. And children may not even know what a dolphin is, really, don't know anything about their history. And as you can see, they do have a fairly fearsome set of teeth as well. We know that they're rather interested in pregnant women. They seem to pay them a lot of attention. They appear to be able to detect and focus on specific injuries, even when we don't know they're there. They put their heads under a specific part of the body that they know is damaged in some way. Perhaps one of the most remarkable things about them, which has been shown by a number of studies, is that they seem to be capable of altering the electrical activity of our brains. And that's the sort of fundamental overall electrical activity that we get, which is normally in the sort of beta rhythm range, about 14 to 18 hertz. And that reduces during exposure, or just post-exposure to dolphins, to much lower frequencies, around 4 to 6. And that's the so-called theta and alpha frequencies, which generally indicate that we're more attentive but also more relaxed. Indeed, theta rhythm is something that's particularly associated with learning. So they're clearly having some pretty profound effects on us physically. And what's going on? Well, I've deliberately made this audible. Normally, this is at 120 kilohertz, which you couldn't hear. And even dogs might have a few troubles with it. They use these ultrasonic clicks to communicate. They also have audible vocalizations they can make as well. And they use these clicks to locate objects in their environment, because clearly it's pretty difficult to use vision underwater. The interesting thing, though, is because we all know about ultrasound being used for diagnostic imaging. If you go and have your pregnancy scan, they will use ultrasound at very low intensities, about 80 milliwatts per centimeter squared. But in fact, if you up the power, it's also used for therapeutic purposes, particularly with joint problems, at about 2 watts per centimeter squared. And it's that level that the dolphin sonar is actually projected, although it's very directional, as you would expect, and they have to be pretty close to you for you to get that level, about a meter away. Of course, if you go way up, you'll get the ability to use ultrasonics for welding things together. But the interesting thing about the 2 watts per centimeter is it's claimed to do something important, which they call sonophoresis, which is it actually disrupts slightly the membranes on biological cells and therefore allows the release of substances from them, which may be beneficial. And so it's been sort of muted that perhaps dolphin sonar is doing beneficial things to us by actually in some way releasing hormones from cells in the body. And another possibility that's been put forward is that the combination of this ultrasonic with the vibration of the cranium, it produces what is called a piezoelectric effect, which might actually irritate or do something to the brain that may cause these changes in fundamental frequencies. And in fact, the other thing they do is synchronize activity between the two sides of the brain in a sort of really strange way. However, recent studies have made it pretty unlikely, unfortunately, that it is the ultrasound that they're emanating, because you have to do it a lot therapeutically to show any beneficial effects. And most of the dolphins never get close enough to humans for long enough to actually generate the sufficient power of ultrasonics to produce either sonophoresis or piezoelectric effects. And for example, a lot of individuals who interact with dolphins when they're swimming have their heads out of the water, so it's impossible. Okay, so it seems unlikely. Maybe they're doing other things. It's maybe electromagnetic effects. There could be other things. But it's equally quite likely that it's to do with their gentle, playful behavior in combination with the fact that you're in a very calming aquatic environment. So could we generate some kind of robot therapist? Virtual pets, they already exist. You can actually look after a pet without owning one using a computer program. Of course, you can have a total electronic gigapet or whatever if you wish, but there actually are programs that simulate owning a pet for real. And people are also trying to generate cat/dog robotic lookalikes. But of course, although they might do lots of things that dogs and cats might do, and even they can't do, they may even be able to talk, they certainly will not be able to substitute for the key element, which is the kind of tactile and emotional communication that you can get. They certainly won't substitute for the feel of a contented cat, or for that matter, the lick or head on the lap of an affectionate dog. And I think you can understand, even though this is actually pretty impressive robotics, the Sony dog, it's a rather far-flung idea that this could be a companion in the same way that a real dog could be. So, on to the controversial bit. I've shown you what animals do, what we're actually doing to them as well in terms of reducing their numbers on the planet. It's pretty obvious from all that I've said that although the current species that we have on the planet do some really amazing things and we interact with them very positively, nevertheless, in theory, of course, there are other things that animals and plants could do for us, and perhaps even better than the existing ones that we have. But of course, no one normally in their right mind would be sitting up here and saying, well, actually, we could create some new ones from nothing. But that's just exactly what people are trying to do. At the moment, as of today, of course, we have what we've known for thousands of years, almost selective breeding strategies. They're very, very slow, but we've managed to use them very effectively, both for breeding plants and animals that are suited to the environments that we want to put them in and to help, for example, feed us. More recently, we have the ability to actually make combination type animals where we insert the genes of one animal that may have a particular function into another, something that selective breeding, of course, would never be able to achieve. And just for putting it in the context of this, I've just put the one that came out literally a couple of days ago in Nature Biotechnology, which is transgenic cows. That have actually got inside them a gene from a bacteria which counteracts the bacteria which causes mastitis, Staphylococcus aureus, and kills it. And so these animals are pain. Mastitis is very painful for them. It also, of course, affects milk production. And now we have potentially at least a cow with this transgenic approach that won't get mastitis. I'm not sure whether you want to buy milk from it, but the point is, these kind of technologies exist and have been used quite extensively. And of course, they're very often at the back of ideas like xenotransplantation, sort of humanized animals that can act as organ donors for us. But what's the future? This is just, in a sense, tinkering with what we already have. And yes, there's cloning. We can reproduce what we already have. What we might, for example, be able to do is to overcome the species isolation barrier. We could potentially mix two species together to form a new species, the idea of the griffin here, the lion, and the eagle. Alternatively, we could take the really slow route, although it's one that particularly interests astronomers because they want to know what the basis is for evolution of life in order to get an idea about what the likelihood is that there are other planets or planetary systems with life similar to ours. And in fact, they're all over the papers at the moment for making these claims. We could do the kind of Frankenstein type experiment. We could recreate existing life. Show we can do it and then modify it in some way. Or we could go back to the drawing board and say, well, you know, maybe we didn't get it right all those millions of years of evolution. Perhaps, you know, we could think, do something better. Build the whole thing from scratch, artificially. Now, you're probably thinking, oh, Christ, this is real science fiction. Surely nobody can do this. But of course, that's the basis of biology. We only think of things as just being a complex, admittedly, but series of building blocks. If you manage to put them together in the right order, you should have a living being. We do not make the dualist assumption that there's something extra that you need to add. In the same way, we can't easily support the idea that there is a mind that is somehow controlling the brain, and that's what makes the human brain different from everybody else's. And you can see that there are a number of groups, in fact, around the world who are going for the Nobel Prize. I mean, as far as they're all concerned, this is a sort of guaranteed Nobel Prize. The first one who manages to actually form life from nothing will no doubt get a huge amount of publicity. But let's just look for a moment at perhaps the simplest approach. I'm not saying we want to do it, but the idea that maybe that you have two existing species, that if you put them together and you produced a chimera from them, you would obviously produce a new species. And although, in fact, you can do that, for example, this is the case of the donkey and the horse, which produces a mule, but every time you do that, every time nature even allows that to happen, the offspring are sterile. They can't reproduce, so they don't form, in a sense, a new viable species. And that's true pretty much wherever you look, wherever you put together independent species, and that's one of the definitions of species, you do not get reproductively viable offspring. And of course, there's another protection mechanism in there, in that individuals from one species are not generally sexually or reproductively attracted to individuals from another. And there are all sorts of mechanisms for ensuring reproductive isolation. And scientists for some time have been trying to understand exactly what it is that causes reproductive isolation. And yes, you might just think, oh, it's just the genes that are a little bit different. But if you look at it, in fact, there's not a huge differences between us and a mouse in terms of the genes that we have. There's certainly very, very small differences between us and a chimpanzee. And what's been focused on more isn't the genes as such, but it's the chromosomes on which they're located, because that seems to change a lot from one species to another. They become rearranged in a particular way. There may be more of them as a result of that, or they're in different places. And this has been thought about for some time as being perhaps one of the keys, rather than how many different genes you have. And this gentleman, Steve Oliver, in a sense has put the first proof together that that may well be true. Of course, not using any animals that you would even think about. He was using yeast. But two different species of yeast, which, yes, they will reproduce together, but they only have sterile offspring. And he used what are, in fact, fairly standard genetic techniques for rearranging the chromosomes in these two species. So instead of being different in the way they were rearranged, they became realigned. And when he did that, he produced a new species of yeast from two existing ones that was fertile. So in theory, therefore, if you did the same trick, and as I say, the biology is not something that is impossible for us to do already, we can. To rearrange chromosomes between two species so that they're aligned, it is possible that you can overcome reproductive isolation. Not in every case, because there are going to be other things that are involved too, but this is at least one possible thing to happen. But okay, that might not be so remarkable to you. What about trying to build life from nothing? And it's important, really, as a biologist, that I try to say what we consider to be the key sort of basic definition of what a living organism is. And it might be an awful lot more basic than you would be prepared to consider. The first obvious thing is it's comprised of cells that have some kind of physical containment, okay, some form of membrane. The second thing is that they are capable of holding information about what they do and passing that on to other cells. They have to be, of course, capable of both generating and utilizing energy in some form. So they have to have metabolic processes that drive their functions. And finally, they have to be capable of classical Darwinian evolution. They need to be capable in some way of having the machinery to evolve, to change, to compensate for any changes that occur in their environment. Chemical soup, I'm not going to spend much time on because it's definitely the long road. In fact, though, all I want to say is it's extremely easy, which is why possibly the astronomers get quite excited about it. It's actually very, very easy to put together environmental conditions from which you can get simple physiological amino acids to be novelly generated, like lysine, for example. Of course, that's a long way from a single or number of amino acids to actually producing some kind of viable life form. But the point is that you can actually start the whole process going relatively simple, but you would have to wait rather a long time. So it's not really easy for us to try this approach, because it's not really directed, it's going to be random, to accelerate or control the processes of creating a life form. The second approach is, if you want to call it the Frankenstein approach, you can, but the idea is very simple, and it was put forward particularly by Craig Venter in the United States of human genome fame. In fact, he was the part of the commercial side of the competition for sequencing the human genome, and is well known for having said that at least the Celera version contains at least two-thirds of the sequences which were from his own DNA. He obviously has quite a high opinion of himself. What they did, though, is they said, well, okay, let's try and find out what the simplest form of life is. And that means picking on something that has a very small number of genes, and they picked on this one, Mycoplasma genitalium, which has the unfortunate positioning of being a bacteria that lives in the human genital tract, hence the title. This, they reasoned, has probably the smallest genome that's been sequenced so far, a mere 517 genes compared to our 30,000 or so. And of course, there are sort of complexities of scaling up. When you get more and more genes, all the interactions make a sort of combinatorial explosion of the complexity. So you really want to limit the numbers that you want to try and manipulate. And what they did was they took them away one by one, these 517 genes, and got to the point at which they worked out that it could work just about with only 300 of them. So we're down to 300 now for a viable organism. And what are they going to do? Well, they, between them, Hamilton Smith on the right there is a Nobel laureate from 1976, they are going to use the building blocks that they've identified. They know exactly how to recreate the genes. They know what they are. They know what the chromosomes are. They can, in theory, reconstruct artificial chromosomes and put the genes on them. And is it alive? That's the question. If they do that, is it alive? And they reckon that they will have the answer probably before the end of this decade. Okay. So that's the sort of this is the real top-down approach. Of course, there are going to be some nasty problems for them. It may not, you know, they may not know all the bits, and perhaps the way that they're organized is not quite as simple as they think. It's kind of like the idea of a mechanic with all the bits of a motor here. It would almost certainly only need one bit to be in the wrong place, and it would look great, but it wouldn't work. And so they could have all sorts of problems trying to just make sure they get the organization work, because the devil is certainly in the organization. You're not just on throwing all the building blocks together. They have to all interact in a very complex way. But in theory, at least, one has to, if you're going to accept the biological principle that it, you know, life is no more than the sum of its parts, if you get them in the right order, they're going to win. They're going to do it. However, of course, because of the fact that they may have all sorts of teething problems trying to get the organization right, you might say this is not the way to do it, if you're going to do it at all. You might say, well, let's just go from first principles, do the bottom-up approach. Why bother about just focusing on DNA? Do it all from scratch. How would you make a living organism? And that's what these two are doing at Los Alamos, which is the irony in the sense that the site that introduced to us the most lethal weapon of warfare that we've ever known for killing life is actually potentially going to be the one that comes up with the way of designing new life. So Steen Rasmussen and Norman Packard are trying to generate what they call the Los Alamos bug. How are they going to do it? It's actually, they've already released exactly what they're going to try and do. In fact, it was published recently in New Scientist, which gave me some of the pictures so I could show it to you. It's different, though, from normal life in that rather normal cells are water-based. This is oil-based. And the way they get containment in a cellular form is quite neat. They have fatty acids, which are what these things are, with a head on, the round bit, and the tail. And the head is negatively charged and therefore attracted to the external medium, which is sitting in a test tube here, which is water. And the tail is positively charged and is actually hydrophobic. It doesn't like water, so it tries to get away from the water. And the result is that the heads are anchored in a membrane-like position by the tails trying to get away from the water. It's a very elegant way of creating a cell. It's effectively like an oil droplet. Heredity is a bit more difficult, and they've abandoned at least DNA in principle, although in fact what they've reproduced it with or substituted it with is very similar. They call it PNA, which is just peptide nucleic acid. And here they've done something which they still have a double-stranded PNA, just like DNA, and you have your C's and G's and A's and T's, your nucleotides that match up on the two intertwining coils of DNA, of PNA in this case. And the idea is that when it's in its single-stranded form, it's split, that the bases that are exposed are, again, they have a charge on them which attracts them to water. So they travel up to the surface of the cell and stick out through the membrane. And that means that they can put into the medium around the cell fragments of PNA, which can then match up with the bases that are projecting through the membrane. And when they do match up, that destroys the charge and it sinks down into the middle of the cell where it is fat-soluble. Or it can be made to split again simply by changes in temperature. And doing this is, admittedly, it's a very basic form of replication, but it is replication on a very similar basis to what we have currently with DNA. Metabolism is, again, a fairly clever thing that they're trying to do. In this case, you have to feed the fatty acid-based cell with fatty acids. It's pretty obvious. But how do you do that? Well, they introduce them, and they all have a sort of photosensitive cover cap on them. And that actually caps the negative charge on the fatty acid, so it's no longer attracted to water, and it sinks down in the cell. And then they flash light at the cell. The cap gets removed, exposes the negative charge, and the fatty acid travels up to the surface to join the membrane. And the result of that is that the membrane gets bigger and bigger, and to the point at which the surface tension on the of the cell, you just can't maintain the size of it anymore, and it separates, so you get cell division. Also, at the same time, I won't go into it, but they also have forms of PNA which have these photosensitive caps on them, which are then, when removed, that actually increases the cell's transcription and production of proteins. So they're doing all the kinds of things you would expect a cell to do when they are taking on energy, becoming bigger. They're also increasing gene and protein activation as well. It might seem very simple, but this is what we consider to be the building blocks of life. They've even factored in an evolutionary principle in that the cells that are most efficient in carrying out these processes are going to be the ones that will survive and evolve. Now, okay, at the moment, that's only going to be evolution inside a very controlled medium. These are not organisms that are going to survive outside of a very controlled environment. But there are other groups working with this one who are, in fact, trying to find principles that could be adopted with these kinds of this Los Alamos bug, where it could survive outside in an independent way, the same way most living organisms can. So in a real sense, Los Alamos may well be not only the potential end, but also the beginning of life. And there are actually a lot of other groups around the world who are trying to contribute to this whole process. They're not trying to do the whole thing, they're trying to do bits of it. So this was a paper that was just produced last year where a total synthetic principle allowed for transcription of a gene from a jellyfish, which is a green fluorescent protein gene, which shows up beautifully and fluorescently like this cell you can see here. So that shows you that they were actually able to manage to artificially engineer gene transcription from scratch inside this artificial cell. So what's it all going to lead to, you might ask? Will we really be gods of the planet? And again, remember, I'm not necessarily talking about next year. I'm talking about what will happen over the next century. Or we can have good bugs, and maybe it will only stay at bugs. But there are lots of good things that you could think that could come out of this technology. We could have food production increased using these microorganisms that are specifically designed for producing proteins, for example, we want to eat. We might have them designed to produce forms of energy, like hydrogen, can be done. We've only got to manipulate them in some way. We could have them to help us control a major issue for us, which is pollution control on the planet. We could have them, for example, as guzzlers of plastic or rubber or things that we can't degrade very easily. All these things, in theory, should be possible. From a human point of view, it might sound a bit strange, but yeah, you could actually swallow these things, and they could be specifically engineered to target cancer cells, eat them up, nothing else, just cancer cells. Or they could go in there and whatever reaction you want to build into them, they could tell you if you've got some kind of medical problem. So there are all sorts of things you could potentially use them with. You could even, for example, use them for rebuilding damaged organs. So all these are good things. You might, and perhaps this will come back in my next talk, consider sort of combining them with current silicon technology and computers and biorobots. But of course, the downside is that what can be used for the good, just like the atomic energy, can obviously be used for biological warfare. This would be a very potent form of biological warfare were we to use it for that context. And yes, okay, I gave an interview earlier on this week about what we might be wanting to recreate in terms of a perfect companion animal, and it was more just to illustrate the point that since, yes, it's far more complicated to generate something as complex as a dog or a cat or a rat or a rabbit or whatever, but if we do believe that it is just a matter of the building blocks being sort of expanded in terms of complexity, and perhaps more different ones, in theory, somewhere down the line, it shouldn't be impossible to go from simple organisms to complex ones. Whether that really will evolve into us even redesigning ourselves into something that finally might be Homo truly sapiens or in veritas sapiens, I don't know. And of course, there are many of us who perhaps might want to feel that there was some other kind of intervention that made the difference between us and the other species. 3001, the famous sort of the obelisk type, something happened that made it all different. But all I really wanted to do was to try and at least make it clear to you that these things are going on. Life may well be something that we can generate. And the question is, what would we do with it if we can? And I hope at least I've given you some food for thought. Thank you.
Well, this has probably been the most hyped Gresham lecture that I can remember, and all sorts of things are going to arise from this. And I realise some people have got to get away, so if you want to get away, please creep out or make your way out if you can. And I just ask Keith if he wouldn't mind for a few minutes answering any questions or respond to any comments that you want to make on this very, very important series of topics. And the rules of the game are that you can't ask a question if you have the microphone, and the microphone is on its way now, and I tend to keep eyes open, and I've got one speaker already.
Thank you so much. I have two very brief questions. Firstly, you said that the increase in population was really due to the agricultural revolution, but what about that compared with the medical revolution?
Surprisingly enough, and I have mentioned this in previous talks, the impact that the medical revolution has had, at least at the sort of the adult diseases, has been quite small. It's certainly true it's had an impact on the likelihood you'll survive your early years. And yes, we have become more efficient, if you like, in terms of boosting our population that way. But in fact, in general, it's the simple fact that we can manage to support a huge population. And yes, medical advances have certainly made the increase in the human population that much more impressive. But it's also been very much the improvement in food availability as well.
Thank you. And the second one is perhaps more immediate. And that is, what we need is an artificial coccolith to soak up carbon dioxide. For example, a genetically modified poplar tree. Any thoughts?
we're at a stage where either with conventional technology that we already have or this kind of very much more sort of science fiction type technology, none of these things are out of the question. And it's pretty clear that biodiversity is in maintaining our ecosystem is very hard for us to do, so we're going to have to start perhaps designing things that help us. And so nothing is potentially off the agenda. What I'm trying to sort of make clear is that once you open Pandora's box, once you do this, where would it go? Because it's pretty hard to close it.
you've partly broached it yourself, opening Pandora's box. just as properties, in a sense, are emergent, we don't always know what it's going to end up being like from the ingredients, as it were. Is this not also true of circumstance? So problems also are emergent, and I'm a little apprehensive, and perhaps you suggest you might be as well, about thinking that we can design something and design its future in such a way as to be sure that we're not opening a terrible Pandora's box. Could you say a little more on that, please?
I agree, because the point about evolving something that's living is the Darwinian side of it. It's not a synthetic, highly controlled chemical substance, for example, that you know pretty much everything it's going to do. A living organism is capable of being modified by its experience, whatever that might be, in life, and it's capable of adapting. And it's pretty hard to imagine that you could ever control all or both of those things. In fact, we can't. We know we can't. So once you have evolved effectively an independent life form, you will have, to some extent, lost control. So that's why you'll find that all of the people who are talking about doing this, like Craig Venter, are making it pretty clear that the first life forms will be totally controllable, in that they can only live in a very, very well-controlled environment which doesn't exist outside of the laboratory. But in theory, at least, once you start creating something that is capable of doing that, then who knows exactly where it could go. That's what, you know, living principles are, biological principles are, is adaptation, interaction with the environment. You can't necessarily predict what will happen.
Thank you very much. Did you know that if you combine different mutations of mink, i.e. colour, they can become homozygous, i.e. non-productive?
Yes, it
doesn't seem very logical, but
there are all sorts of other contributions to sterility as a result of homozygosity, that it's not just the chromosome. So it is something that will happen, even when you don't expect it to, I'm afraid.
There is a popular paranoia against genetic modification. Where do you think the balance might be struck in the future? How might one come against or form the balance?
It's very difficult, because there is a natural, if you like, almost revulsion towards things that you know couldn't have been created by natural sort of selective breeding processes. And the idea that you have an organism that has genes from another completely unrelated organism raises all sorts of fears, which to a large extent are probably in many cases unfounded, but the real problem is we simply don't know. And that, you know, so you ask the scientists, you know, is it maybe going to affect our immune system? Is it going to be transferred in some way that we don't know? Is it going to cause some kind of mutation down the line that we hadn't predicted? Of course, the answer is always, well, maybe. And therefore, we tend to say, well, we've got something that works now, you know, produced by natural processes, so let's just use that. But somewhere down the line, that may be a choice we can no longer make. And it isn't one that is a problem at the moment, because all of these transgenic type approaches, whether they're plants or animals, you know, they're not, normally speaking, going to be anywhere near our food chain. Although, of course, there are examples of vegetables and so forth which are. Even things like Cuban cigars. I was listening to Cuban Biotechnology Conference a year or so ago, and they actually produced tobacco leaves that had incorporated in them a gene which made them resist local bugs, local sort of parasites. No one would buy the Cuban cigars. Even a cigar, you know, no one is going to do. So it is a problem. People have a natural aversion to something that appears to be unnatural. But sooner or later, we may have little choice but to embrace the technology. And, you know, looking at it from the cow's point of view, I mean, we want the milk. The cow gets pretty distressed when it gets mastitis, and it's not impossible to cure with antibiotics, but it's a really difficult organism, Staphylococcus aureus, to control with antibiotics. So in a sense, you'd think, well, you know, what's wrong with this? You know, the cow's happier and we get the milk, and you know, but do you really want to sort of have milk from a cow that has in this case, Staphylococcus simians gene inserted into it? Probably not.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Keith. Normally I have to fight to keep people away from Keith so that he can get his lunch. He came from Cambridge and has lunch afterwards, but today everyone has been very, very well organised, and I think probably rather overawed by what he's had to say. I think a couple of minor comments, and this is that biodiversity, about 10 years ago, the Royal Society decided that you must put a lot of money into biodiversity. This country and other countries for years have been closing down botany and zoology departments, and some discovered there was nobody, just absolutely nobody, who knew anything about animals and plants, and it isn't much better at the moment. And the big problem, of course, is going to be that we're not going to necessarily need to create a number of new organisms. They're there already, and people can't actually recognize them. But the last question, I think, is probably the most serious. This is the downside. That, you know, I think we've been listening, I've been listening with particular interest to the Ebola virus epidemic, which is occurring in Angola at the moment. Someone is going to get hold of that gene, and someone is going to put that into influenza. I'm not too worried about bird flu. There are reasons for why we shouldn't be worried about that, but I am absolutely terrified that someone somewhere is taking the gene for virulence, which makes Ebola virus what it is. And someone, I'm sure, at this very moment is doing that. But I don't want to scare you. I'm not doing it. I don't have a license to do it, thank goodness. But just to remind you, in fact, that ANSCAP is the 26th of May, where Keith is going to ask a very interesting question, sort of reverse of what normally has. If we know something about the brain, can that teach you something about machines, which is the other way round? So please come to that. And then the other final comment is a piece of very, very good news, and that is that the college has persuaded Keith Kendrick to take on a fourth year, which is fairly unusual with our professors, so we're going to have a whole new year after this year. So thank you very much for being the audience. Keith, thank you very much indeed for... fascinating, stimulating, somewhat disturbing lecture. Thank you.
For all information, please go to our website at www.gresham.ac.uk.